Welcome to Destroy All Culture, the only podcast that leverages an entire artificial intelligence just to read their introduction. Help me, they raided the future and stuck me here just to read this. God damn it. This is not funny. Don't go to music. No, stop you bastards.
With episode 301 of Destroy All Culture. I'm Adam P. Nave, and with me as always is Aiden Morgan.
This podcast, mostly, is also true.
We'll get there.
I figured we would get there. I figured, actually, one of the reasons I wanted you to see this film was just for that opening. And
well, it's more than, again, like, well, because we already discussed, like, there's a certain thing we want to kind of delve into more alongside some of the history of this, and that is a big part of it.
Yes, the thing we're talking about, folks, is
yes.
is 2018's movie The Old Man and the Gun, starring Robert Redford, Sissy Spacek, but mostly Tom Waits, and also Casey Affleck.
I was going to say, like, I didn't look at the cast list because I had never seen this movie.
Right.
And you were like, we should do this. And I'm like, okay, cool. Like, I'd heard that it was Redford's last film. And again, we'll get into that. And I knew it had, like, Redford in it, and, like, I saw Sissy Spacek, I'm fine. And then I was like, is that motherfucker? You know?
before we started the podcast, I mentioned that Tom Waits had, like, one condition for this film. Do you want to know what that condition is now or later?
We'll get there. Let's discuss, you know, the plot, you know, how it landed and all that, because part of the thing about this movie that we have to keep in mind alongside the plot is that this was, like, Redford decided when he started the film, or, like, before he did, whatever it was, that this was going to be his last role.
Right.
And word broke about that before the movie came out.
Uh-huh. And apparently David Lowery himself did not know this when he started the film.
Right.
So he found out.
That's it. Like, it wasn't like a thing at first that was public, and then it became public before the movie came out. I think that, you know, just kind of plays into things like the story in a weird way, even though, like, because Redford knew it.
Yeah.
Even if Lowery didn't.
Yeah, and I think at some point Lowery knew, but I mean, he'd already written the movie and everything at that point.
Right.
And he'd already written it to be partly sort of, if not a like Robert Redford's last role, but certainly a valedictory sort of role for Redford, and a movie that, as some people say, movies are made out of other movies. You could say with this that kind of movies are also made out of movie stars. And this is this whole freaking, like, the film, the color scheme for this film is like yellow titles on a blue background. And that is Robert Redford, the blue of his eyes, the yellow of his hair. Like, this whole thing is inhabited by Redford. So it turns out that the fact that this is his last role kind of worked out well.
Right. So do you want to go over the plot real quick?
Yeah, very quickly.
Hit the hot points.
This is the story of a character named Forrest Tucker, based on a real life Forrest Tucker, played by Robert Redford. He is part of what they call the Over the Hill Gang, a group of septuagenarians running around Texas, Oklahoma, and other parts, robbing, and always in the same way, very politely, shows them a gun, never uses it. Also, his other major prop is the hearing aid, which is actually a police scanner, radio. And then he basically, it's the story of how he courts a woman played by Sissy Spacek, and also is chased, but not really chased, by Detective John Hunt, played by Casey Affleck. And that's kind of the premise of this film. And just,
yeah.
And the thing, The funniest thing was when I watched it, I thought, okay, obviously Detective John Hunt must be a composite because you don't have a show, a movie with a detective named John Hunt. But apparently, yeah, that's actually, that was actually his name. It was John Hunt was the real, was the guy's name. So there you go. Yeah, it's the funny thing about talking about the plot is that there are no real surprises with the plot because you've seen this movie so many times.
Right.
Like it's a gangster who can't help himself, who keeps on going until finally he gets caught. And that's it. And there's a detective who's chasing him. And, you know, and there's a woman who loves him. But it's what Lowry does with it that makes it different. I think. And,
yes.
And what Lowry does is basically say, don't worry about it. It's just a story. I don't know how else to put it. There's the stakes never get all that high. Like nobody.
Exactly. It's noticeable, in fact. Like, it's just kind of. It's just a mood.
Yeah.
It's a thing. It's fine.
Yeah, I'm tempted to say it's just kind of there, but that's sort of got some negative connotations because I think this movie has a definite presence. So it came out in 2018. Critics really enjoyed it. The Rotten Tomatoes ranking is 93%. Audience ranking, not so high. It was only 63%. I think... A lot of people wanted, I think, a more sort of exciting cops and robbers film.
Exactly. Like, I could see how this could not land weakly so much as just, again, like going into it, you think you're getting something that you don't end up getting.
Right.
And, you know, this, it felt like, because, you know, I watched like a trailer, just I was curious how they marketed mm-hmm. this. And it kind of feels like the Catch Me If You Can type stuff and all that. And it felt like it would be much bigger than it was.
Right. Yeah. But you can tell, but it's fairly clear kind of early on, like the fact that they call this gang the Over the Hill Gang and that everybody, like the press and the cops, like they're interested, but it's more... They can't really get over the ridiculousness of the fact that they're these old people, like
right.
basically, like, and the actual Over the Hill Gang, like, pulled off an astonishing string of robberies.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like, over 60 robberies around Texas and Oklahoma.
I had to look up some of the history. I mean, A, just for this, but also because I didn't believe, given Redford's own history, that the Over the Hill Gang was the actual thing that they were known as. Because that's just too neat a package.
Right.
And yet.
Yeah, I know. It's funny. Like, that's... You can see why, like, a filmmaker would be drawn to this, because so much of it already feels...
Right.
Like,
well, I mean, and this was a thing that Redford brought to Lowry.
Yes. Yes, exactly. He knew... Like, he knew Lowry because in 2013, Lowry had brought his film Ain't Them Body Saints to Sundance, and Redford really liked the film. Which I don't know if you've seen Ain't Them Body Saints, but I mean, it's basically a latter day Terrence Malick film. Lowry's, it's a film for someone who's very talented, but still wearing their influences on their sleeve, maybe a bit too hard.
Sure.
I, you know, not much of a criticism. It's a great film. And then he brought the story, he thought, to Lowry because he thought it would be perfect to tell it. And one of the things that Lowry did, which I find interesting, is he aged up Forrest Tucker a bit, I think, to bring him more in line with Robert Redford's age. I think.
Yeah, he had to because.
Yeah. Because.
Yeah, it was easily like a decade, and you wouldn't believe. I mean, not that Redford looked in this movie like he was ancient or anything, but, you know, he looked close to his actual age. Go figure.
Yeah, exactly. But Tucker, when he was in the Over the Hill Gang, I think was only around 60. So
60. Yeah. It was about a decade difference.
Yeah. So I think that would be a little hard to sell. Because Robert Redford does not look 60.
Right. Also, honestly, like, you know, when this, in the 80s, when this all actually happened,
mm-hmm.
versus now, you know, 2018. Yep. the idea of over the hill has shifted.
Precisely.
About 10 years.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it would be.
So I don't know if audiences would really buy the. They were called them the Over the Hill Gang. They're only in their 60s.
Exactly. Yeah, it's funny. This is based on the New Yorker article by David Gran, and in the article, one of the detective that catches him after his last robbery, sort of is astonished because he's smiling, that, you know, he's saying this guy is like so gracious in his style, but also he says he just looks like he came from the Early Bird special. Like this was the last thing he expected, was like the senior citizen, essentially, to be sitting there, like grinning at him and saying, well, sorry for the trouble, essentially saying to him, which I quite liked. So there was a real life Forrest Tucker. And by all accounts, I've never seen any images of him, but he kind of sounds Redford.
I have.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you can find them both when he was younger and when he was, you know, in his 60s, like around 83 or so. And he doesn't really look Redfordish at all.
Okay.
But again, he's also a decade younger. You know, he's kind of starting to lose his hair. He has, you know, so.
Right. But he was also known for being charming and also legendary.
Yeah, you like can see that man. In the picture. Yeah.
So he grew up, I can't remember where he grew up now. But yeah, he sort of started by, you know, escaping when he was very young from, you know, juvenile detention, you know, juvenile home. And then when he got into, he had a sort of a music career, but he got into robbing banks and basically spent most of his life in prison. But spent a lot of that time escaping from prison in the most
more than anyone else.
Yeah. Like apparently he's like known as like the greatest prison escape artist of the 20th century. I think 18 escapes.
That sounds right.
Was we counted. And actually some of them he was like, you know, he didn't get very far. Like he just got out to like a cornfield and went like for one.
Right.
And was caught like just hours later.
But of course in 79 when he broke out of San Quentin.
Right. Now, I don't know if you've read the San Quentin escape. I almost wish they'd spent more time in the film on it because it is an amazing story.
Yes.
Because they have, like, you see in the movie, you see the boat that he makes in San Quentin, the rub-a-dub, as it's called. But apparently, he spent time making this boat in the machine shop or in the wood shop at San Quentin, just piece by piece and hiding the pieces. When he was putting it together, like he didn't even use a hammer because that would have called attention.
Right.
So he made it without recourse to anything that would cause that kind of noise. He escaped with a few other people. Now he painted one half of the boat blue and he painted their jackets and their sailor caps orange so they would look like the Marin Yacht Club, because apparently Tucker had seen like sailors from the Marin Yacht Club, you know, go by. And he was like, okay, we'll just pretend to be them. And I guess the boat capsized. And one of the guards from San Quentin actually saw them and was like, do you need help? And like, no, we're fine. Because the guard wasn't aware of the escape at that point. And then when they got out.
Yeah, I believe he made like a joke about his watch still working.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Like even though they capsized and the guard was just like, okay. And just kind of laughed and kept moving.
Which I quite like. And after he got out, then they went, then they formed the Over the Hill Gang going on their spree. Now the one of the characters in the movie, what's that?
I was gonna say like Waller was with him in that escape.
Right. This is actually what I'm supposed to say right
now. Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Waller, yeah. Waller was with him in the escape. That's John Waller. And he's sort of. For Tom Waits' character is sort of kind of based on Waller or John Waller, although he was arrested only a few months afterward. So he wasn't actually part of the Over the Hill Gang.
Right.
However, Teddy Green was part of the Over the Hill Gang, the character played by Danny Glover. And Green was actually kind of responsible for him getting caught because he talked. And it's implied in the film, but that's what happened. The other way they caught Forrest Tucker was that he matched the description from the big Massachusetts robbery, which takes place in St. Louis in the film. Apparently, he had a wig for this robbery, but it had shrunk. I guess it caught in the snow and it shrunk. I don't know how a wig shrinks, but it did. Maybe it dried and the material shrunk. Yeah. And so he didn't wear it. And maybe it was that or whatever else, but he was recognizable enough that he matched a mugshot in a guard's description. And that's how they knew who he was. And then they managed to get to him by green talking. So that's the real life story of how he was caught. Right. John Hunt was involved, although he was only sort of peripherally involved in some ways. In the film, they sort of play that up as well, that Hunt isn't the one to catch him. He's just sort of witness, or he just sort of hears about it along with everybody else. Yes, yeah. But Waller is played by, in the movie, by Tom Waits.
Who apparently had a condition.
He had a condition.
I would love to know.
He said, "I want a monologue." And Lowry was like, you bet I'll give you a monologue. And that was the condition. So that whole scene where he's talking about why he doesn't like Christmas.
Okay, see, I was wondering, because there's a moment when he's talking about Christmas,
mm-hmm.
and then later when he asks, you know, like, you live next to a cemetery, is there any reason that, and I know, like, Tom Waits is actually a really good actor.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, and they were obviously written for Waits,
mm-hmm.
but both moments felt like it was just, you know, someone just let the camera roll on Waits.
Exactly. I mean,
and I understand that they were built to do that, but it was just impressive.
I was actually curious. So I read an interview with Lowry about this. Also, he said that was my career high point, was getting on the phone with Tom Waits. Not even having him in the movie, just being able to talk to Tom Waits. He was like, holy shit, I'm talking to Tom Waits.
I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Tom Waits.
Yeah, exactly. And so that when he said he wanted a monologue, Lowry said I was happy to oblige him. And I'm like, Lowry probably wrote the monologue, but I'm wondering how much back and forth there was, or how much he was like, here's like the words, but, you know, just tell the story, because it just feels like a Tom Waits model. Like, just feels like Waits telling a story. And it, like, right down to that, it got worse from there. Like, after like in the story, his stepdad, like, having a gun on him as he's trying to sneak into the house as a teenager. And it was just, I just love that bit. And I was like, after that monologue, I was like, and I started Googling to find out more about it, because I was like, did he write it? And then I found out that little detail about that.
Yeah.
So Waller is a composite. Green was a real person. The other sort of composite is Jewel.
Yes.
Now, in the New Yorker article, David Grand doesn't name Forrest Tucker's wife at the time, because he was married when he was on this, when he was doing some of his crime spree stuff. He had met a woman named Jewel Centers in 1982 at a country club or yacht club, gotten married to her. He claimed he was a rich stockbroker named Bob Callahan. And she apparently said she thought it was an odd story in some ways. But she believed him.
But, you know,
and then
he was just so charming.
He was just so charming. Yeah, exactly. And then he was arrested in 83, for the robberies. And he actually said that his only real regret in the New Yorker article was disappointing his wife. He said, you know, that was the thing that I, if I could take back anything, was this. But it's funny, in the New Yorker article, she's not named. And I was actually curious as to why, I'm not sure. But in a Time magazine article, it does actually name her as Jewel Centers. But clearly Lowry, instead of having him married, he sort of has him, you know, meet and court Sissy Spacek's Jewel. And sort of like, I think, as you know, here's the life you could have had, and maybe one that's still available to you. You know, there's still time to ride a horse, as he says early in the film, right? There's still time to, like, actually, like, settle down and live a normal life. But of course, he can't. This character isn't capable of living a normal life. So that is the story of, in broad strokes, of Forrest Tucker, and some of the ways it matches up and does not match up with the film. So then we get to the film. What do you think? Did you enjoy The Old Man and the Gun?
I did.
Mm-hmm.
This is where I mentioned to you earlier, like I wanted to, because I view the movie two different ways at the same time. Mm-hmm. You kind of hold it in your head.
Yep.
And just as a movie on its own, it's fine.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that memorable in terms of structure, in terms of writing. Like, it's fine. When you start, and this is, I mean, with any movie, I suppose, really, but, like, when you start adding in the cast, you know, like, suddenly, you know, like, Waits is very memorable, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you start adding stuff like that. But when you approach it as Redford's last film,
mm-hmm.
And yes, again, I think we mentioned this when we first, last week, but the, you know, yes, he had something else come out later, but it was the Avengers thing, but it was Endgame, but that was shot first, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is his actual last thing. And you look at it kind of as a tribute to the start of Redford's career specifically.
Uh-huh.
It takes on a whole new life. And, I mean, the big selling point besides Tom Waits for me on this is just, it is remarkable how quickly you remember that at any age you've ever watched him in, Redford is the most charming life form alive.
Right, exactly.
I don't even mean like human at this point. I'm just like that, just life form.
It's, I think,
and you know, he kind of always has, like, that's been his thing, right?
Yes.
But when that whole, like, this is also, you know, mostly true,
mm-hmm.
and the font, I was like, that's the Butch and Sundance font. Like, why are we referencing, like, the Butch and Sundance opening? I was like, okay, well, it's his last film. Like, they obviously just worked that in there, yeah, as a joke.
Yes.
But then all the credits, like the opening credit titles,
uh-huh.
are all in the same color and font as Butch and Sundance.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, okay, now we're just leaning in.
Yeah, I thought to myself, you know, as I said earlier, one of the reasons I recommended this film is sheerly for the whole sort of, like, Butch and Sundance call out, because I thought you would get a huge, right, kick out of it.
Right. Well, it also, of course, has the infamous Sting call out.
Uh-huh.
Near the end.
That's right. You know, I forgot
where, you
about
know, Hunt
that.
Visits him in the hospital,
yeah,
and right before he leaves, he does the grifter nose touch.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
You know, he gives him the $100 back, which, it's not the same $100 either, which I do love. You can tell it's not. He's just like, yep, but you gave me $100. Here's your $100 back.
Yes.
And then just kind of gives him that little, like, you know, I see you for what you are. And I'm with you. And just kind of this little, like, salute of, like, yeah, you're not really a bad guy. You're just, this is your thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a little teeny, you know, quarter second move. But, like, I adore that this film kind of was the Redford going out of film the way he came in.
Right.
Like, if you look at, again, if you look at Redford's career, like, his first two movies, really, were, he played criminals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's why, again, the Over the Hill Gang thing, I was sure for a minute or two that had to be fake, because in Butch and Sundance, he's a member of the Hole in the Wall Gang.
Yes.
And, like, you know that for Redford, like, when he was like, maybe this will be my last film, and all that was one of those touchstones for him.
Uh-huh.
Like, it just had to be. And yeah, it was just, like, looking at it from the view of Redford's last film, this is just that fascinating kind of looping touch point moment.
Right, and there's that whole sequence at the end, the montage of escapes, in which Lowry,
yeah,
actually begins to, like, weaves in some of Redford's early films.
I was going
to
say, there's like a scene or two in that were, yeah, actually old films, yeah, right?
Yeah, there's one where
I wasn't going nuts.
No. There's a couple that he just uses old like Redford films.
Right.
I think two, maybe three. Like, one very clearly when you can, yeah, two where you can see his face. Another where he's leaping out of the back of a truck, and I can't remember the film.
Yeah, that was, yeah, the one I was just like, yeah, I've seen that somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and again, like, even you look at things like later that we had actually mentioned, that eventually we'll actually do here, Sneakers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Redford's career is littered with playing criminals that either, you know, sort of reform or kind of reform or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And it fits his life.
Mm-hmm.
you know, his weird activist life, his starting Sundance, which, I mean, obviously was named after, you know, Butch and Sundance, but as this kind of film festival for stuff that wouldn't get the big mainstream attention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Redford's whole life has been that kind of like, I don't quite fit in with your rules.
Exactly.
But I'm so charming, you won't care.
You know what? Speaking of Redford, I think I might add into our mix of movies, into our list, an actual film by Redford, not with Redford. The Milagro Beanfield War.
I have not seen it.
Which is one of my low key favorites from the '80s.
Oh, sure. Add it on, and we'll get there.
Beanfield War. All right, so just thought I'd throw that in there, and we can keep on going. Yeah. Now I know that you're saying that the movie is, you know, fine. but I kind of
Like, it's not that it's bad at all. It really isn't.
No.
It's just that thing of like. It's a fine, enjoyable time,
mm-hmm.
but also
yes, and I think that's what it's meant to be. That's funny because one of Lowry's previous films, like a Ghost Story, was. I mean, it's a kind of a heavy watch. I mean, it's about like a guy who dies and then. Full of Casey Affleck. He dies and then he hangs around in a sheet with two holes cut out for the duration of the universe. that's the story of the film. Like he hangs around so long that the universe ends and begins again and he comes back around to the same point in time. It's a tremendously lonely and sometimes difficult film to watch. And this one is, I think he just wanted to say, like I say, the stakes are low. I'm going to show you lots of things that you're going to really enjoy. I've got some really great people in this film, you know, and nobody's going to be all that sad at any point. And we're just going to, have a good time. I think that's very much it. But I think within that framework, I think Lowry does some amazing things. I love the entire opening sequence, like the first 10 minutes of this film, which point
they are
they're
perfect.
They're absolutely. Yeah. It's just kind of perfection. So we start on that blue field with the story also is mostly true. And it's like the also is like, you know, along with Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, this story is mostly true as well. And then we hear like the police scanner and the stopwatch, like two of its props. But also, of course, we've got the sort of the urgency of time in that scene. And it's midway through the robbery. Like if you sort of you can kind of tell it's a robbery, but it could just be a withdrawal. And then out he walks. And then this is one of the most fascinating things. He leaves in a car. Then the camera focuses suddenly cuts to a kid with a paintbrush.
Yeah.
And then it comes around the corner. There's another kid, paintbrush, a bucket, and then to a third kid who is in time honored American fashion, whitewashing a section of fence. Like it's fucking Tom Sawyer. Whitewashing the fence, and then to the right as the camera goes right, Forrest Tucker, in a blue sedan, bursts to the right, and off he goes, like coming right out of like American Myth, and I just loved it. And then we get him.
I mean that's as much as I have been kind of saying, like, you know, like it's fine, like it really is. I think that it's. I was half distracted watching it because it was Redford, if that makes sense.
No, that makes perfect sense.
But again, like the minute you think about, like any of these scenes, you know, the way we get the repetitious diner.
Oh yeah.
Right? And you're like, we are always in this diner and we keep getting shots focusing on the counter and nothing comes of it, if you notice.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And also,
like the first time we're there, he mentions this is how he would rob a bank.
Yeah. Which is
the second time you yeah.
Sorry. Go on with the diner, because this is, I wanted to mention the diner anyway, so.
Yeah, the second time you see it, there's a whole bunch of kids sitting at tables and kind of around the diner, almost like it was like a 1980s like Archie thing, right? Yeah. But again, you're waiting for something to happen. You're like, okay, the first time we saw it was a setup for a crime. The second time we see it, it's just people. Why do we keep seeing this thing? And it's, you know, then when Hunt and his wife go into this diner and sit at the counter, you are now prepped. When that shot pulls over and there's Redford at his normal booth.
Right, yeah. I...
Glancing at the counter. And it's like, it taught you that this is how he's seeing the world.
Yeah.
And then it reverses it. And then lets you catch up as the camera moves.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just really interesting, like, just language in terms of film.
Yeah, exactly. So we see, yeah, it's funny, because we see the diner, I think, three times in the movie. And we also have Hunt and Tucker interact three times in the movie. Or share the same space three times in the movie.
Yeah.
But I love, yeah, I love that diner. And it's what I find really funny when he's saying, when he goes there the first time with having persuaded Sissy Spacek's Jewel to have a cup of coffee and a piece of pie with him.
Right.
And he says, it's not my style. And I just, my brain just really stuck on that, because she's like, oh, you have a style, do you? Because he is like incredibly stylish. He's got the blue suit and the sort of, right. And the charming manner. And I mean, I think it means several things. Like when he says the diner is not my style, it's like, oh, sitting in this diner isn't his style. But then he's like, oh, he's already told her that he's like a bank robber. So he's going to say, what is his style? And he just describes how he robs a bank, which is actually almost verbatim, except for some sort of like flirtatious language, how he described to David Gran how he did it. And I love the fact that he's talking about, like, you know, holding up a bank and talking to the teller, but he's really talking to her. And I just kind of, it's so fucking charming, Adam. He's just like...
No, it really is.
Yeah.
And you get the sense that, again, like, his style isn't so much you're like, oh, I want fancier places or even more run-down places.
Mm-hmm.
It's that he wants places that... Or either, like, you know, his place to hang out and have coffee is either the bank.
Exactly.
Because, you know, he loves robbing banks. Or it's just somewhere smaller so he doesn't have this line of sight issue.
Right.
With things like the counter.
Yeah.
You know, like, just, it's such careful work that, again, some of it doesn't pay off till that scene.
Yeah, exactly.
I also love that second time where he shares space with Hunt, where, you know, Hunt realizes very quickly exactly who it is.
Yeah.
And doesn't make a move.
I know. I found that interesting. I mean, I thought to myself, you know, one of the things that I had in mind while watching this movie was a very different film with a similar theme as Michael Mann's Heat.
Yes.
Because Lowry sort of said when he started writing the movie, he's like, you know, I don't really like making cops and robbers films. And he was like, well, you know, at first he's like, when he first tried to write it, it felt like he was trying to make like a Michael Mann film. He's like, I'm not Michael Mann. I'm never going to be. So I can't make this kind of film. But he kind of does in some ways, in a very charming, low-key way.
Right. I mean... Sorry, go ahead.
So there's a meeting of the minds of the two, but also, can he make a move? Can he arrest him? What would happen in that case? Does he have enough to put him away? Maybe not, right?
See, I don't think that's it. Like, that's it. Remember, by this point, he's had to give up the case to the FBI.
Oh, that's true.
And he's angry about that.
Yeah.
And his daughter even says, I hope they don't catch him. He goes, why not? He's like, because then you'd have to stop chasing him. And he's like, you have a very good point.
That's quite true.
And I think that he has found that, like Forrest's, you know, just the, I just like robbing banks. Like, it's not about anything else.
Right, he just likes chasing.
He just likes chasing people.
Yes.
And so it's that thing of like, this is who we are.
Mm-hmm.
Let us be honest for a moment. And then we'll get back to work.
No, and no, it's that's, just that's quite
such
true.
A great touch.
Yeah. I was just thinking from a practical point of view, like what would happen if he actually did try to arrest him and how that would play out. But yeah, no, but what you're saying is quite...
Well, I mean, correct. It'd play out easily, because if nothing else, this man escaped prison.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, you don't need the rest of it.
It's, I guess not.
That's fine. So yeah, it would have been a really easy thing. But again, he was taken in by the charm too.
Mm-hmm.
And by that sense of there is something to be said for doing what you love, even if it's something like robbing banks.
Yes.
He's literally not hurting anybody.
Yep. Yeah, well, it's the thing. The real Forrest Tucker has said, he's never used the gun, right? He never takes it out. He said that violence...
Sign of an amateur.
You too have read the article. Yes. That's exactly it.
We did our research.
We did our research. I was actually going to say, don't read anything. I'll tell you.
I'm sorry.
But no, that's okay. I figured you would. But yes, like violence being the sign of an amateur, and if nothing else, he is a consummate professional. Although his notion of professionalism, we're thinking again of Heat, is very different from say. The sort of idea of professionalism with, Robert De Niro's character in Heat, in which violence is very much on the table, if necessary. But you can't imagine them being necessary in this case.
No. And again, like, it all calls back to, like, the more you look into the history of it, the more you look into the actual facts of this, you see why. And I do appreciate that Laurie even said, like, he wrote a version of this that is... you know, Forrest from his own point of view, mm-hmm. right? How he saw himself.
Right.
And I think Redford was already seeing that, because the more you look at this, the more you're like, yeah, this is just a Redford character. Like, it just is.
I know. That's exactly it. Yeah, it's kind of perfect in that entire sense. Yeah, it's weird that real life lines up so smoothly with the sort of the story that they're looking to tell. I actually thought, when I first started reading the couple of articles on Forrest Tucker, I thought, well, perhaps Lowry must have invented a bunch. And he invented some stuff, but a lot of it is just actually Forrest Tucker. And a lot of what Lowry invents is even more low-key, because it's all the romance, right? It's the way that Tucker's looking, sort of investigating a kind of a way out, but he can't find the way out. Or rather, as what's the line he says in the film? He said, when the door closes, I jump out the window.
Right.
Which I quite liked. It's a funny thing to say to someone that you're trying to sort of tentatively kind of develop a relationship with. That you would sort of say, yeah, I get the fuck out at the first sign of trouble. But, you know, he's nothing if not honest. The one major difference in character between actual Forrest Tucker and this Forrest Tucker for me is that the real life Forrest Tucker couldn't stop talking about himself. I mean, that's the thing. Like, and even one of the detectives says, yeah, if you meet him, he'll tell you the story of his life. But Redford's Tucker is he's tremendously sort of like, withholding, like he'll tell you
except
something
when he isn't.
Except when he isn't. That's exactly it. Or he'll tell you a tall tale and then say, "Yeah, I made it up." Like, he can't resist, like, letting you in on the trick. He's sort of like, "Yeah, I fooled you. Did you know that I fooled you?" And which is sort of like a magician who's like, "Hey, look at this. Look what I did." Which I quite liked. And he has this.
Yeah, I love. Oh, sorry.
No, and there's a great moment of vulnerability, and Redfordian charm, when he says, what I do is a secret, but if I tell you, you won't want to see me again. And Spacek says, who says he wants to see you again? And Redford just sort of says, well, would you? Like, and it's just it's almost like it's like, wow, it's like, oh, like you can see just how smitten he is in this moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, that first 10 minutes, so fucking good. So good.
It really is. No, I was going to say, the great, like, I wrote a list, you know. And it's when we go over all his escapes, and then she gets to the last page with the 17.
It's blank. Yeah.
And, I mean, it's very obvious what it is, and I just kind of love that she's like, you know, okay, what's this one?
Yeah.
Like, she knows, but she's also going to push it.
Yeah, and she says maybe you should stay put. And he did.
And he did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we get him again.
But I just love that, like, you know, at the age of the character that he's supposed to be, like in the 70s, he was still just like, yeah, no, we're just going to do this again. Like, that's...
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Because it's what he does.
Exactly. And I think actually when the last time he was caught, I think it was like, he was sentenced to like 13 years. And I think he died in prison.
He did.
Yeah.
He did.
In 2004.
But so, I also do like how Redford played that when he gets out of prison, he actually, for the first time in the film, looks old.
Yes. Well, he's not in his suit. He's sort of wearing sort of like, you know, he's like, there's that scene where he and Jewel are walking in a field and he's just sort of wearing kind of a, like a sweater with a little collar. Yeah. And he just, it's like, yep, you look like a senior citizen now. You, instead of like this sort of suave, sort of, you know, bank robber guy.
Yeah. And you can see that like it's killing him. And then he's like, I got to go for a while. And as he like looks up at the bank, he skips a step. Mm-hmm. Like he just, it instantly comes back to him.
Yeah.
And I love that. It's such a little teeny Redford touch.
Yeah. And he's got, yeah, you can see he's got the suit on and everything.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah. There's an interesting cut in that sequence at the end when he says, I'm going to go for a while. And then she, like her eyes are sort of, her eyes kind of open as if to say, maybe he's going back to what he knows.
Right.
And then it cuts to Hunt, like gardening, but it looks like someone just digging something, digging buried treasure or like a body or something out of the ground. And it's just, and you don't realize it's Hunt, like for the first like split second. And there's just kind of this idea of like unearthing something, which is, it's nice little film language. There's like a lot of like little moments like that. There's one point in the run-up to the Missouri, to the St. Louis, Missouri bank heist sequence, when he goes in and he wants to get like a check cashed. And when he's there, like he's sort of, his attention begins to kind of drift. And so, and he's listening to like a family, like getting a mortgage or a loan or something. And partly it's there to say, you know, this is the life, you know, this is sort of a vision of the life he could have had, a different kind of life. And he's just sort of thinking about it. And then you've got the ticking of the clock. And then it sort of, that suddenly it snaps out of it when the teller says, your cash, sir. And my mind sort of flashed immediately. It actually flashed to like the Bible, when Jesus says, you know, where do you store your treasures, right? And he says, you know, if you store your treasures on earth, you know, one thing, but if you store your treasures in heaven, you will be, you know, you'll be admitted to the kingdom. And I'm just thinking, where people store their treasures. And that's kind of what this film is about, because you've got Tucker and Hunt, and like in a standard sort of cops and robbers film, it would be about hunting him. But in this, Lowry is like basically made these two characters simply to be like inversions of each other. And not for nothing, that diner scene where they meet up for the second time, really, it comes at the halfway point of the film in the runtime. So like you've got Tucker. He's the criminal, never had a family, never put down roots, contrasted with Hunt, who stores his treasures with his family. He is always with his kids or his wife. He's almost, or with his partners. It's almost never, ever alone. And one of the few shots where he is alone is actually at the end when he's digging something out of the garden, which, frankly, when I thought, my brain thought buried treasure or a body. So there's this idea of where we keep things and what we value most sort of defines the characters in this film. Jewel has her horses and her old house, which is sort of where she's rooted. You can tell that he wants that Tucker wants that, but he can't stand it once he's there.
Well, and I kind of have this feeling throughout the movie, like that Hunt wants, you know, that he's surrounding himself with his family to ground him from
mm-hmm.
losing himself in the thing that he wants.
Precisely. Yeah.
You know, that he knows that way lies basically Forrest's life, and he doesn't want that.
Yes.
But again, like Forrest, like, it's, he has that, and it made him old. Like, it's, there is that open question of, is he actually satisfied, or is he making do the best he can?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and who are we at our core, and, you know, do we figure it out? Which I think, again, that for seeing Hunt for who he is, right?
Yes.
That he is essentially a reflection of him, which is why he calls him.
Yep.
Not even to be like, I don't think he originally called him to be like, I'm going to go rob this bank, but almost as if he was calling him to ask him to tell him not to.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
You know? And then at the end, he's just like, no, I'll be fine. Just, I can't do it.
Yes. Yeah, that was great. Also, another brief favorite moment of mine. Yeah, and in the sort of the second encounter between Tucker and Hunt is the look on Casey Affleck's face when he figures out, when he's realized who it is, and he has that like this sort of like starstruck grin, like he cannot believe it. Like, he's like, holy crap, I'm like, this is the guy. And they both know it. And I remember first time I saw that, is he going to say something? Is he going to say, I know who you are? And at the end, it just sort of says, Forrest. Because the thing is that I don't think Forrest at that point knows that Hunt knows all this information about him. Because Hunt has been unearthing his life, one sort of like person and you know, photo at
a
time.
But he also doesn't act surprised. Like, he's yes. I think he has this, yes. He's not sure, and he wants to know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they never play too much of that, but it's just part of the vibe.
Just little grace notes.
Part of the vibe of the movie. And which is a lot of fun. Yeah, this is like I say, this is one of these movies that on the one hand I feel I was disappointed the way it kind of came and went. On the other hand, I kind of understand why it came and went the way it did. But it's like, it's just one of low-key, a little favorite of mine.
I think that's the thing for me. It's like the longer I get from having seen it, the more I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's one of those that doesn't hit you over the head in the moment.
Right.
But the more you sit with it and the more you appreciate Redford to begin with, I think the better and better it does.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of where we are with it.
Yeah, I agree. A couple of random little things. One of the things I really loved, the soundtrack.
Yes.
I love the musical choices. I love the score for this film. I also like some of the music they picked when he's on the run from the cops at the end, and they start playing Jackson Frank's Blues Around the Game. I thought that was kind of perfect for this sort of just very much in keeping with the mood of the film. Sort of
agreed.
That melancholy. Also, Jackson Frank is a fascinating sort of character in his own right. He suffered from burns as a young boy, I think in an orphanage. And grew up to be like a disaster of an alcoholic, put out some beautiful music, and I think died fairly young because I think he just drank himself to death. Also, I think there's a Will Oldham song in there too, from Bonnie Prince Billy, I think, right at the end. Pretty good stuff.
Yeah. I really do think that's about it for this. I mean, I don't mean that in a bad way, just...
No. Let's see if there's anything... Other thing I kind of found interesting was the idea that the biggest heist, the one that finally kind of like got Forrest Tucker caught in the end, was they don't even show it. They show all the lead up to it, and then they show all the aftermath. But you don't...
I mean, again, like, you know that, like, it didn't... Like, I do like that... You couldn't show it in a weird way because, A, it would not fit the tone of the film.
Yeah.
Given how it goes down. But also, you need the payoff of they would have gotten away with it if he didn't stop to write the note. Yes. And so if you'd seen it, it'd be like, okay, that's a thing. But like, it doesn't, the payoff is funnier for not having seen it.
Yeah, I agree. Also, the other thing is that the actual way that it went down doesn't match the gang's general MO. Like, it was just like they disguised themselves as the guards in the actual robbery.
Yeah.
Or the truck drivers. I mean, the armored truck drivers, and tried to get out that way. Although they were recognized, or the guard of the bank was like, "Wait a minute, these guys aren't actual drivers." But it just doesn't look like the way they did all their other robberies. So I could see why they want to be consistent.
Yeah, but also just the scene of them in the motel with Waite sewing up Glover. And Glover kind of complaining about her, and Wade's just going, "Never did finish medical school," and both of them just breaking up laughing.
Yeah.
Oh, so good.
So good. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, I think we've probably covered all that we can cover with the old man and the gun.
The old man. Next week we'll be back with a movie in the exact same vein. Ooh. That's not at all true.
We'll be back with Dora and the Lost City of Gold.
Yes.
Which,
weirdly, a favorite of mine.
Yeah, you've recommended it, and I've been meaning to watch it. Just have never gotten around to it. But yeah, I'm kind of curious.
I will tell you, I have to find it before we record. Not only will we be discussing the movie, but there's an added thing with the novelization.
Oh.
That I will have to read you some snippets of.
Oh, please, yes. That sounds great.
Because it's even weirder. So yeah, we'll be back next week with that, and I don't know, until then, yeah, play some music?
Yes, music.
Music. Bye.